So a little bit of a recap on the things that we saw. We were analyzing in particular a protocol for communication using atoms, if you want, or particle detectors. And it was basically Alice, if you remember, Alice signals by coupling or not her detector to the field. Bob's writes down a one or a zero. Sorry, Alice sends a one or a zero, whether either coupling or not. Bob receives a one or a zero by measuring the detector and seeing if it's excited or ground. Excited one, ground zero. And that way, he can read the information from the probability of finding Bob excited from what we call the signaling terms. And remember that we had some initial, because of the initial state of Bob, we have some initial excitation probability. There would be some noise. And there would be also a signaling term. The signaling term, by the way, could be positive or negative. There's nothing. It's not a probability. It's a term in a probability. Okay, so there's no signature for S. Okay, could be negative, or S could be subtracting from the probability of excitation above, or could be adding up. Uh-huh. Good. So in the other thing that we discussed is that in the transition probability for Bob, there are different terms that are proportional to different powers of the coupling strengths of Alice and Bob. And we identify some of those terms. So we have here local noise terms. Those are in the P here, are proportional only to the coupling strength of Bob. And we also have signaling terms. Signaling terms are the ones that are dependent on the coupling strength of Alice, that can actually make the state of Bob, or in this case, the probability of Bob, feel that Alice is present. It would be different if lambda is zero, Alice is not present. From lambda I different from zero, Alice is present. And we distinguish these two kinds of terms into the ones that involve actually the classical way in which we picture communication, in which Alice sends photons, Bob captures photons, which is an order four kind of process, from what I call here Casimir-like interactions. Interactions that have to do with the fact that Alice modifies the field and Bob feels that modification of the field without energy exchange between them. Questions about that? All right. We also saw that the signaling parts, and this is going to be useful at the end of the lecture, the signaling parts were proportional to integrals in time over a quantity that is basically the expectation value of the commutator on the support of the detectors. All right. We also saw that in order for the Casimir-like interactions to exist, for this term not to be zero, we cannot have our detectors in, let's call them classical states if we want, states without coherences in their density matrices. So in particular, if they're in eigenstates of the detectors, ground or excited, then this term would be identically zero, and the first leading order signaling would be of only the real photon exchange contribution. All right. So back to the problem that we ended the past lecture with. The how much information survives a cosmological cataclysm. So at some point we will pick a model, but this is kind of model, the result is completely model independent. That we're gonna use a model of quantum bounds predicted by Luke quantum cosmology. We don't need to stick to that one. I'm not advocating for any particular preference of describing early universe quantum gravity. In fact, if I had to advocate for one, I would advocate for none, because I don't think any of them is satisfactory yet. Anyway, we're gonna pick one, but it doesn't matter. The feature that we're gonna use is the fact that that the early universe physics involve some bounds here. Okay, so there's whatever some pre-bounds era of the universe. There's something is labeled here in this plot as well. So yeah, okay. So we have a quantum geometry, or what we call here quantum geometry, is just some phase in the early universe where maybe, well, we know GR is not gonna cut it. And maybe we don't even have a geometric description of space-time. We don't care. Something happens here. Well, we would care for what we're gonna do. We're gonna assume that near to the bounds, we don't have really the loss, completely loss of geometry, okay? This is one of the predictions of Luke quantum cosmology. You're not gonna lose geometry when you get here. You will get corrections that come from like post-Einsteinian corrections. Quantum gravity just corrects dynamics. It's not GR, but but it's also you still have geometry to talk about and a metric and so on. That doesn't have to be what it is, okay? But that's what we're going to assume here. Okay. Right. So we were saying that, yeah, atoms or any complex systems for that matter, I mean, think of anything with a small level of complexity, including like protons, neutrons, things like that, will not survive a quantum bounce. The reason is that the energy density would be too high and those bound systems will disintegrate. Okay? Right, so imagine now that you're a very, again, what we said, an ancient and advanced civilizations that lived for like a long, long time before the bounce era, that to our best guess, it probably looks something like that, right? And then you don't want to, you know that, you existed for trillions of years, and then you cracked all physics, you know how everything works, but then you're worried because you also know that there's gonna be a bounce and the energy density will be too high, and you're not gonna survive that, and your atoms are not gonna survive that, and you cannot create a box containing your knowledge because that's made of matter in general, like condensed matter. And condensed matter, I mean, even protons. So yeah, those things are not gonna survive. So what can you do? All right. So, idea. Let's encode the information in quantum fields in the background. Say that we have a scalar field, massless scalar field to simplify things, using particle detectors. So you get the, you encode your information in your detectors, you get your detectors to interact with the field, get the field entangled with your detectors. How much information are you putting in there that can be read out later on if we have a species as advanced as that one? Okay, a species that can know the optimal strategy to do it. All right, so it's gonna be very dark. I'm sorry about that because for cosmology it kind of makes sense to me. But anyway, so we were here, we were talking about the fact that something like a quantum bounce, if we still have a geometry, even if we have a quantum description of gravity, we believe in quantum, let's call it like that, then information cannot be destroyed. Now, again, something else could be true. It could be maybe that at those energies, somehow we don't have conservation probabilities. We don't have unitarity. I personally think that that's not something that resonates with me. But I don't know. Some people think it might be the case. Unitarity maybe is not as sacred as we want. But if we assume everything's quantum in the way we talk about quantum theory, then yes, information cannot be destroyed. In quantum information, or in general information, cannot be destroyed. You can argue, can it be created? And then we can have a debate, I guess. The debate is different if we talk about classical information, quantum information. We can talk about Landauer's principle, and that's super interesting. That's about thermodynamics. So what really happens when you erase something? But that's not the topic now, okay? Although we will talk a little bit about thermodynamics and quantum information in the next lectures, a little bit. But in any case, if we talk about quantum information, and even classical information cannot be destroyed. It can only be scrambled, okay? And scrambling information looks like this, okay? Let's increase the difficulty. Let's make it a complex problem to recover the information, to reconstruct the information. So yeah, the idea is maybe looking at the scrambled information, right? That we have when we measure, when we make antennas coupled to the field, possibly quantum antennas if we want to be optimal. The idea is that maybe out of this mess that is completely scrambled, maybe we can recover information that was encoded there before the bounce era, and perhaps recover that civilization that maybe teleported themselves into the future by getting their states entangled with degrees of freedom of the field, okay? Again, this is just a pictorial way of thinking about it. It's not serious. Although I know that this picture kind of induces to think that it's probably serious and rigorous, but no. Okay, it's just a cartoon. So the scenario would look at it a little bit like that. So you have an Alice. So this is the scale factor in the FLRW metric. So we have a time in the past before the era here where energy densities are high. You had Alice living, and then you have Bob living in this era afterwards, okay? Same thing again, but in black. So what do we get? So we can do, I'm gonna save you most of the details. you can do a similar calculation to what we did before. Keep in mind all the structure of what happens with the bounds, all the energy density increase in the field, and all the effects that have to do with the fact that geometry is now being not obeying GR, but something else. It's already taken into account the moment, because if we have a geometry, we can compute this signal in estimator, we can compute it in arbitrary spacetime, and in particular in this bouncy spacetime. And what one gets is that, again, you get violations of the Strong-Huygens principle that survive a quantum bounce, and there is information. In fact, you can have a channel capacity, you can establish a channel from pre-bounds and post-bounds that transmits per use of the channel 10 to the minus 14 bits if you use coupling strengths coming from the electromagnetic field. That doesn't sound like a lot, but trust me, there are many atoms. So you can, in principle, use this channel many times and send bits through a quantum bounce. Okay, so a cosmological cataclysm is kind of way more innocent than it seems. And then there was a question yesterday about, but hold on, I mean, that might be what your math say, right? But intuitively, how do I make sense of that? Because I would expect something violent erases, above all later on, erases information and nothing's gonna survive. We're gonna discuss a little bit about that. So far, this is cold math, okay? If you apply the cold math that we derived step by step, assumptions for that math, quantum field theory works. Engineers that use this classical channel capacity know what they're doing. The geometry of spacetime is always a geometry. When you have quantum effects, it's just a correction over that over Einsteinian physics. You don't get to a regime where you cannot describe spacetime as geometry. Under those three assumptions, you can have a quantum bounce that get energy densities of the order of the Planck scale, and still information will make it through. Yeah.
What if there are phase transitions in the quantum fields?
What if there are? You mean if you include interaction terms?
Like symmetry, like going to more symmetric states and then symmetry breaking again.
This is a very simple model, so that will change things definitely. In this model, we assume we have a scalar field that is free. So because it's free, there's no potentials, there's no phase transitions. But yeah, indeed, in reality, you have many, many fields coupled to each other. You would pick probably, if you want to reproduce this, you would pick detectors that couple to a field that couples weakly. Then again, then you need more detectors because the coupling strength is what gives you this kind of thing. But no, yeah, for sure. If there are interactions, the information will get scrambled through all the fields that interact. So perhaps it's not enough to look at the electromagnetic field or a scalar field or whatever you're looking at. This is just, I guess, a matter of first principle, as in like, does it even work? Is there any information that survives that? Is the fact that the energy density increased a lot making the information not make it? So in principle, there's no first principle reasons why not. That's the point. Then again, it will be way more complicated. And of course, if you have couplings, that thing will get really, really scrambled. That's a question, yeah.
How does the new civilization even recognize this information? And once they do?
They don't, they assume. So the assumption would be, right, let's do an experiment that if someone actually encoded information in that way, we will recover it. This is, okay, the pre-assumption in this protocol always is that you have a protocol to follow. So you are assuming that Alice is sending and you are receiving and you have a protocol to follow. But then again, it doesn't matter because the channel, for what, this is a matter of information discussion. So this is a lower bound to the channel capacity because it assumes a particular protocol. Channel capacity is the optimization of all protocols. All that we're saying is that there is information contact. You can send information through.
Okay, sure.
We're not proposing that the civilization will definitely be restored with this protocol.
Okay, sure.
So the information makes it. That's all that we mean.
Okay.
It's recoverable.
Okay. What does a calculation for the channel capacity look like?
I can show you. Yeah, there we go. So you go to this reference. There is a reference in it that is it's classical information. It's a reference to a paper in classical information that derives this channel capacity. Let me tell you a little bit how. It's not trivial. So the channel capacity of a given protocol says, okay, imagine that I'm allowed to use the protocol sending random sequences of bits to encode information, meaning that I not necessarily encode information with a one or a zero using the channel. I may use redundancy because it's noisy. I will send, instead of a strategy of communication with the channel, instead of sending 1-1 and 1-0, let me send 1,000 ones and 1,000 zeros. That redundancy will make that at least statistically, when you get more ones than zeros, you know what you're getting. That's an example. If you optimize over all possible tricks that you can do, in order to encode the information reliably, when you optimize over that, then it's the mutual information. So it's a mutual information that you acquire in the random variable B that you're measuring with respect to the random variable A when you optimize over all possible strategies of sending. Now, that has an expression that is not complicated, to be honest. It's not complicated, but it's a function of the probability expressed as probability plus noise. So signal plus noise. Okay, that's what we want, actually. That's what we have. When we plug in our expressions, then we get a leading order in perturbation theory. You get that is proportional to this S2 square, this signaling estimator, second order of the signal estimator. It's the thing that was proportional to integrals of the commutator and lambda A lambda B square. That's the best I can tell. I mean, what it is conceptually is that. It's an optimization of the amount of information. What is mutual information? Mutual information is telling you how much uncertainty I remove from the random variable A when I make a measurement, when I obtain one bit of information on B. That's the mutual information. The channel capacity is that optimized over all possible strategies of sending ones and zeros through a channel, through a physical implementation of the channel. This channel capacity, the noisy asymmetric binary channel capacity, is what you get, is the thing that reproduces the closest the bit rate that you have in a download when you're downloading something. When you're downloading something and you get, I don't know, 5 megs per second, this is the kind of thing that you get in 5 megs per second.
Okay.
That's the closest that tracks that. All right. For more rigorous, I mean, to see actually how it's derived is in one of the references of this. You look for this formula in the paper, and just before that, there's a reference for this. All right, now we have to go through all the animations. Oh my, I'll just warp through it. Right, so let's talk a little bit about, it's related to the question, why is the information not washed out? I mean, it's been a long time. All right, so let's talk a little bit about looking for signatures of quantum gravity today, just to have a brief description of actually how much information from early universe physics can make it to nowadays. This is inspired by the question yesterday. All right, so problems with quantum gravity. I mean, everybody loves quantum gravity. It actually drags the most intelligent people in, well, I mean, I don't know, at least based on objective proof, we have like the most relevant physicists based on the usual metrics. And the hell of a clever person, it's doing string theory. He's the father of M theory. Ed Witten was here recently. He's the most cited physicist ever. It got more citations than Einstein, if I'm not confused. He's a history graduate too, which is interesting. Anyway, so I love history myself, but I'm not a history graduate. So yeah, definitely it's challenging and it's interesting because it tries to answer very fundamental questions, so it attracts very good people. Now, the problem with quantum gravity is the lack of falsifiability. Now, according to some philosophers, in particular, according to Popper, for example, which is kind of like one of the less contested philosophers that ever existed, yeah, what makes science science is falsifiability, the ability to falsify it. I mean, in principle, of course, string theory and in general quantum gravity, it's falsifiable. The problem is that it's very difficult to falsify. Extremely difficult to falsify, all right? So from the point of view of a physicist, it might be even not falsifiable, right? Because you say, okay, it's falsifiable only if there's a finite number of experiments that can falsify it. Okay, fine, there's a finite number. What if it's 10 to the 500? So it's a little bit of a problem if we don't find, and that's not a problem of people doing that or the discipline. This is a problem of, wow, this seems to be freaking tough, huh? Quantum gravity, people have been looking into that for a long, long time. And I mean it, for a long time, almost a century now, huh? Not as much, but 80 years, yes, with different ideas. How can we understand gravity, the most innocent and the first interaction we actually understood, but we didn't? And now the only one that we had no idea about from the fundamental point of view, or so we believe. Maybe we don't have any idea about anything. That is possible. Anyway, so the problem with testing quantum gravity is that we need predictions. We need, therefore, experimental data that encodes quantum gravitational effects. Yeah, this is kind of, I kind of changed my mind a bit about that statement, because to be honest, and I'm not going to talk about this here, but you can have low energy physics experiments that are sensitive to high energy scales. You know how? Well, have experiments that have time scales and length scales within them that may conspire to multiply themselves and cancel a Planck scale order. That there are results, and we can talk about them at some point, maybe on Friday, because I think I may be here for the tutorial. I'm not sure, but it's likely. Is it Friday?
Yep, Friday.
Nice. I may be here.
Is that what Mina does?
Huh?
Is that what Mina does?
Say again?
Is that what Mina does?
There's atoms, for example. Atoms that are switched for fast times. So instead of like waiting a long time and do scattering, if you do scattering processes, you wash out all the scales of the problem. You wait too long. There's no information there about fast stuff. It's averaged out. If you look at short times, you have other scales. And those scales, if you're clever about it, maybe can conspire to actually get the high energy scales closer to you by multiplying by other scales that make dimensionless quantities that are larger. There are results on that. There are several results of that. Detecting Lorentz, if there were Lorentz symmetries breakdowns at low energy. Also detecting, there's a proposal in nuclear physics, if you want. It's complicated to do, but it's a proposal in nuclear physics, so energies of MEVs involved, to detect effects that come from causal set theory of discretization of causal structures, right? Like, not even having a geometry. So when you do the continuum limit, you get a quantum field theory with scales, a non-local quantum field theory. And by the same token, some proposals from string theory, because they also end up with effective theories that are non-local field theories. Non-local field theories are quantum field theories that involve higher derivatives of the field. Klein-Gordon, you get second derivatives. If you involve higher derivatives, you need information for more points, right? There's a non-locality scale, roughly. Anyway, but then again, the lore, and I wanted to battle it a little bit, is that, yeah, you need to reach Planck scale to see Planck scale physics. Maybe not. Maybe not. We see quantum physics every day. Well, not every day. Well, yeah. Yeah, every day. We have computers. We see quantum physics every day, and we don't have to go to energies that are comparable to the quantum energies of the system. It's because, well, we have other scales, right? We have buildup of a lot of effects on some scales that build up and get you the effects, the macroscopic effects that are a consequence of quantum. So anyway, that's a debate for a different case. For a different case, if you're interested, for if you want to talk about it. But for now, let's just take a more standard discussion and say, well, okay, the most promising window is cosmology, because in cosmology we have access to early universe physics, kind of, and maybe when we have gravitational wave sensors that actually can detect the gravitational wave background, maybe we can get information about even earlier scales, so more energetic scales. Definitely directly with a particle collider, we're not going to get there. Never say never, but no, that's very difficult to get there. I mean, impossible. So cosmology might be the only way. I don't think it is, but for the sake of the argument, bear with me. All right, so question. Yeah, but you know, whatever quantum gravity theory you have, it's only different from what we see right now in the early, early, early universe. Quickly, it became something that is well described with GR, right? Whatever it is, the theory quickly died, as in like, well, quickly we have GR. So maybe we had a Planck time of quantum effects and then a universe, a Hubble time of the same theory as classical. So if there's information there, maybe that information is no longer there. So much time has passed, right? Maybe it's not recoverable. And there's also the problem of the coherence, right? You mentioned a little bit of that, and we will address it later. Like, yeah, in fact, fields are not alone, so you consider always they're undisturbed and only interacting through matter, through atoms and stuff like that. We'll talk a little bit about that at the end, too. Okay, let's do a toy model, which is what we do. To be honest, sometimes we call that toy model standard model. Sometimes we use just an atom coupled to a field. But basically, it's toy model is what we do. More or less complicated to capture more or less things that happen. All right, we're going to analyze the information about the early universe that there is in the Gibbons-Hawking radiation. Remember, the Gibbons-Hawking effect is the fact that a commoving detector in the Sitter space-time Well, in general, the Gibbs hockey was proposed for the sitter. We're not going to assume the sitter. I'm going to talk about the kind of space that we have. It's basically the fact that a commoving detector will see particles in the adiabatic vacuum. All right? It's related to the Hawking effect and to the Andrew effect. So yeah, a particle detector, we talked a little bit about it when we talk about harvesting being sensitive to the background geometry. Okay. So we're going to see if there are signatures in the Gibbons-Hawking effect, in this noise, this echo, if you want, that you see if you have a particle detector and you switch it on, in the noise that it would see in a cosmological background about what happened in the early universe. So for that, let me have a particle detector that is ancient. It's been coupled to matter fields from the early stages of the universe until today. Questions you may have, but there were no atoms then. Agreed. And we will discuss that again at the end. But for now, let's bear with the toy model, and then at the end we evaluate how many things it captures, okay? But let's just assume that we have a particle detector that's been coupled to matter fields from the early stages of the universe until today, okay? Question, would the detector conserve any information from the time when it witnessed the very early universe dynamics? Doesn't mean, what that means is like, okay, the detector existed forever. We still have things that interacted and been interacting forever. Okay, if we look at those things, is there any remnant or has it been erased? Because so much time has passed. And it's been coupled through the field all the time since then. So what happens? Does this detector get any information? All right, so again, we might as well use a prediction of one theory of quantum cosmology. In particular, we use a prediction from Luke quantum cosmology. As you see, if you've seen GR, you may recognize this equation almost. Does anyone recognize it? What do we call it?
Freeman equation.
That's right. That's the Freeman equation. So this Freeman equation is actually without this term. That's the Freeman equation. Now this term here is a correction that comes. This is a, if you want to call it some critical density, there's some critical density in which the Freeman equations are corrected. If you want, this would be the first order correction to Einstein equations coming from quantum effects. The same way we correct Newtonian gravity adding extra potential terms. That would be another term that you add in that equation. So this is a term that when this critical density is huge, and because there's an L here, call this, I don't know, Planck length or whatever you want. There's a length scale there, and that length scale is really tiny. So this density is huge. So this, if the density of the fluid that source gravity to get the space that we have is actually not too big, then this term is zero, and we get classical GR. If the volume of the universe decreases too much and get closer to L cubed, then we're going to get that this term becomes comparable to one, OK? And then you get corrections from quantum effects. Now, if you solve that equation, the dynamic you get for the scale factor is this. So here it is, the GR dynamics in a matter-dominated universe, polynomial, OK? And here it is with a correction at it. So as you see, basically, you get it's already drawn. So you get it here. The two expressions for the scale factor are different for values of t comparable to L, but they quickly become the same thing. So they're only different. Oh, by the way, of course, GR predicts a Big Bang singularity. That's the standard cosmological model prediction. Look, quantum cosmology predicts a bounds. So there's no singularities in there. And I'm only plotting half of it, of course. All right. Ah, by the way, yeah, thing that is never talked about much. For this calculation, for the field and so on, we'll assume a torus geometry. That's standard in what people do in the quantum cosmology. That means that the universe is periodic. That's the kind of topology we have. Is that incompatible with observations? No, not quite. Observations are. So if you see a torus geometry, then you know there is a torus geometry. If you don't see it, it might be flat. It might be just a torus of a huge radius. So it's not incompatible with observations. No? And then again, for the volume of the universe, so what is important in torus geometry is when this volume is small. Okay? But this is what allows us to define a vacuum properly and to do the calculations properly. All right? You would not expect that to be a determinant factor for this, because no signal is going to be going around. Okay, we're careful with that. The torus radius is large enough. All right. It's not really important, as we will see, for the point that we want to make. Right. So, again, consider a massless scalar field in the conformal vacuum. Okay, the proper time of Komobin observers does not coincide with conformal time. That we know already. So, we need to recast conformal time in terms of the proper time of those detectors, Komobin time. Okay? Or that detector in particular. Well, the relation in the GR case is easy. The relation in the quantum gravity case, it's easy-ish. Huh? If you see, this thing quickly becomes the same. So maybe you don't see it here, but for times that are much larger than L cubed over this quantity, then you get that the two times coincide except for a synchronization constant, okay, that we can compensate for, of course. The expression is kind of looking complicated. It's a hypergeometric function, but trust me. I mean, trust me, you know that. Among all the math that it could be, this is trivial. Because we are lucky. I mean, we are lucky. No, we have a bias, I guess, that we try to build models that tend to have solutions that are easy to write for our brains. Something to think about. The unruled model, you already know. So let's get over it. All right, let's evaluate the probability of excitation that you have already computed with me. OK, let's say the detector is point-like, OK? Just to make it simpler, so the smearing is a delta. And then we compute the transition probability coupled to the conformal vacuum. All right, so this is a conformally coupled field. Minimal coupling would be even more different. So that's not really a big limitation, assuming that. Right. So we have the leading order terms. It's an integral over mode, sum over n. N is the wave number. And of course, this is assuming the torus geometry. So we have a discrete number of them, probably very close to each other because the radius is huge. But it's a sum of integrals from the t0, that's the switch on time, to t, the time right now. OK? Now, that integral has this form. As you already know, you already knew all that. We computed that already. It's a Fourier transform of the switching with some factors. Good. So let's split the integrals in two parts. And let's do the calculation with two models, GR and quantum gravity. And let's see what the difference is between them, OK, the difference in the predictions. Right. Let's build an estimator that we call the difference in the prediction of the transition probability from quantum gravity to the classical model. All right? That's just the difference. All right. And let's split the integrals inside the guts of these people. They're not people, they're equations. I know. So inside the guts of these equations, there's integrals, this modulus square of an integral, and we split the integrals into two periods. One, t0 to tm, where the two cases, the classical case and the quantum case, are different. If you want that from t0, the switching on time, to the Planck time, something like that. So that's early universe effects. And then another part that is from tm, from this matching time, where they're no longer distinguishable, to nowadays. In the quantum case, we add this delay factor. Okay, we want to compare on equal footing. We synchronize the clocks, all right? Because otherwise, we're not comparing the same things for the same amount of time and so on. All right, so, all right then, what's the difference between, so what expectation? Perhaps this thing that is on forever is huge, is the most important contribution, is going to dominate over this one, the early time contribution. That would be true if there were no expansion of the universe. That would be true in the quantum optics regimes. The short time scale is not important as compared to the long time scale. But here we have a dynamic of the background. So, well, let's see what we have. This delta P, if we compute it, it's basically, well, is a difference between two sums of a modulus square. So what we get here is, yeah, the modulus square of the early part, the modulus square of the early part, classical and quantum, the difference between the two, here we have the difference between the long-time regime, between the classical and the quantum. So if this term wasn't here, we would say, yeah, maybe this difference dominates this difference, and there's no information. It's been washed out because it's been on too long. Key point, look at this. Look what this is. This is the classical model, in this case, the contribution from Tm to T. It's a huge contribution. And it's multiplying the difference, so the early universe difference. So this is a difference between T0 to the Planck scale, T0 to the Planck scale. And that difference here is multiplied by this factor. So the difference between the two probabilities would be zero. This, you can reason, will be probably zero. This, you can reason, would be probably small, same as this. These two things would be small. You're comparing early universe signal with from early to now signal, if you want, contributions. The key point, though, is that this is multiplied by something as huge as whatever signal was accumulated, whatever contribution to the probability was accumulated from the Planck time to now. So in principle, you cannot say zero directly because this thing is of the order of the inverse of the zero you would get. So let's actually compute it and see what we get. Now, you can argue, hold on. You may be capturing dynamics that you shouldn't be capturing because your detector has a time scale. So in mind that your detector, you need to assume that omega is comparable to the energy scales of the Planck scale. Of course, if I have a detector that can probe directly the Planck scale, I've already won, and I can just measure quantum gravity directly. No, you cannot assume that the detector is Planckian. You need to have a sub-Planckian detector. The gap of the detector has to be much smaller than the Planck frequency. Right, another one. You cannot observe the detector for times that are comparable to the Planck scale. You cannot just do the detector now. I'm going to make observations on them as fast as the Planck scale. So I'm going to stop the time with a precision that is Planck scale. No, you cannot. So you need to average the signal. There's going to be noise if you do it that fast, and that noise may have information about quantum gravity, but just because you're doing it very fast, you get into those scales. So no, let's remove some of the information. Let's average in time for times that are much larger than the Planck time. OK? So two limitations. The detector is a Planckian, cannot be directly accessing the Planck scale. Second limitation, I cannot look at the detector that fast. I don't have the resolution to measure the response of the detector on the Planck scale. I need to average out over that. And this T, this is my resolution of my experiment. That's going to be much larger than the Planck scale. All right? Under these two assumptions, we'd build an estimator, which is the already average relative difference between the predictions of the quantum model and the classical model divided by, let's say, the classical model. All right? And then we get that this, of course, this difference, it's also averaged over some time because, again, the relative difference, you cannot evaluate at an instant. You also have a very long time of average for the difference. So we are erasing time information at two levels. All right. Let's see what we get. That relative difference is exponential with the size of the space-time. With the size that the quantum scale, if you want, the quantum length scale. If you increase this, if this is of the order of the Planck scale, the difference is tiny. But if it grows far away from the Planck scale, the difference grows exponentially. Exponentially. So this puts bounds to the scale. Of course, it's upper bounds. And the upper bound is like it cannot be many times the Planck scale. Because if it's many times the Planck scale, we would not agree with the predictions of particle detectors nowadays of things that have been known forever to begin with. So if you could observe things that have been known since the coupled to the field since the early stages of the universe, the response of those things would not go by predictions by a huge factor if L is 10 times the Planck scale. Question. I mean, you may not be too worried. I mean, again, yeah, just to remind the view of the assumption. So low energy gap as compared to the Planck scale. The detector cannot see the Planck scale on its own. Observe nowadays, far from the Planck scale, and long detection time as compared to the Planck scale. We average in over time, okay? We cannot really see with Planck scale resolution. So we're not hiding Planck scales inside this E. we erased all the information that is not already in the long-time regime of the plant scale. Now, you may wonder, and I will be fast here because you may not wonder, so I don't know. Remember how important it is to be adiabatic in order to get nice responses of detectors? So question, is this a switching effect? Keep in mind, if you switch your detector on suddenly, when people do in quantum, and this is a note of warning for you and the future, when you read books and they write integrals from, I don't know, minus infinity to t, or even t0 to t dt to write time evolution operators, you've seen that, no? I mean, most books, they write that. There are assumptions. That's not innocent. People tend to think, yeah, the state was t0 at one point, and I look at it at t. The looking at it at t involves a violent process. Involves, oh, now I will be able to access the state at time t. The interaction or whatever you're evolving was suddenly switched off at time t. In general, you don't have that. You have a different measure of integration, which is this. Oh, not that. This. If you want. That is what can be adiabatic. No evolution that you cut suddenly can be ever adiabatic. All right? Unless you really do it forever, which is what more people care about in scattering theory, and that's why it's not a problem. But if you're considering finite time processes, how your interaction is switched off, what you do, if you actually do a projective measurement or something like that on your system at the very end, that's a very violent process. That is not adiabatic, all right? So careful when you have limits in those integrals because it's non-trivial. Just writing a t is not like, oh, it's innocent. No, it's not innocent. You are asking different questions if you have a t here or you have an infinity and then switching off non-adiabatically. So there are assumptions when you write those limits that are very rarely discussed. All right then, so is this a switching effect? Because maybe you switched on too fast because you're considering sudden switching. Well, actually, we're not considering sudden switching because that's divergent. But here are different switchings. One that is continuous, but the derivative is not. One that is, this is not an adiabatic one, it's got two scales, a switch on scale and a duration scale. A question?
Sorry, I'm still a bit lost as to why we have this sub-Planckian assumption.
The detector. Oh, because if it's Planckian, you're cheating. Your detector can resolve itself the Planck scale. So if your detector can resolve the Planck scale, of course, the physics of that detector are not going to be easy to explain assuming quantum field theory, because the detector can stay behind quantum field theory. It's probably faster than the times that you average over to get quantum field theory. That's the whole point. That would be cheating. If the detector could prove Planck scales on its own, the scale of the detector is the Planck scale, that's cheating. We're introducing Planck scale physics from the detector side, which is not what we want. We want all the Planck scale physics to come from the early universe time, not from the detector. So I'm not allowed to include Planck scale in the detector gap or in the measurement resolution, because that would be artificial. I would be introducing that. All right, so the different switchings here is that one is continuous, but derivative is not continuous. This is class infinity, but non-analytic. This is analytic. So all of them. This is the different prediction for all of them. As you see, there's not a strong switching effect. The predictions are very similar. Of course, there's different predictions, but they're very similar. I mean, there's exponential growth. All right. So we can consider different scenarios. For example, detectors were switched on at a given total volume of the universe. When the universe was a particular amount of volume, I switch on the detectors. Or you can think, maybe not. Maybe we want to switch on the detectors for the same amount of proper time, because that's what we can determine. In both cases, you get the same results. All right, that doesn't matter. It's not really a synchronization problem or a comparing things that cannot be compared kind of result. Anyway, the point being, in any case, is, well, for sure, in the early universe, there might not be a notion of geometry, okay? But there has to be an intermediate regime, no matter what, where you can actually describe space-time as geometry, perhaps not with Einstein equations, but perturbed Friedman equations. Like, let's call it post-Einsteinian gravity, all right? Then information about these corrections makes it all the way to nowadays in the noise spectrum of vacuum fluctuations of things that are coupled to the field forever, like for that time, and can be recovered probing at low energy. Now, what is a particle detector? For sure, there's not going to be atoms in the early universe. But you can think of, well, a multi-level system that couples to the field and breaks conformal symmetry. anything like that is a detector. We get a toy model of a two-level system, but it would be very similar with any other system. Maybe more difficult to, to measure, to probe. But you can think of a massive quantum field or a mini-money coupled quantum field. Of course, you have the problem. Yeah, the recap, I'm going to just skip it because of time. But you have the problem that you have the coherence as well. Your fields are not alone. They interact with a whole lot of fields. You have a whole standard model coupling things to each other. And in those times, the interactions might not be negligible because the densities are high. So what about the coherence mechanisms? So quick answer, mostly unknown. What we know, though, it seems that quantum information is impacted. Classical information makes it. So the information that we're measuring is not quite quantum. It's actually classical in this particular analysis that I did. If you want a better, there's a review, there's this one. But then again, there's many papers that's kind of old now. But it reviews what is known about the coherence mechanisms in quantum field theory in expanding universes in general. It seems that with simple models, like Gaussian models and so on, people just lose coherence fast. Okay, so coherence, quantum coherence is lost fast. But classical information seems to make it. I don't know, it's more the mostly unknown to be the most important bit, though, because that's assuming a lot about how those mechanisms work, all right? All right. So again, these conclusions, just to summarize them very briefly. We've seen that there's a channel, there's a way to communicate using atoms coupled to quantum fields that is not just exchanging light, exchanging photons. So if you have a telescope, that's cool, but that's not the only way you can gather information from events in general. If you are in space-time that do not, where the Strong-Huygens principle doesn't hold, then you can actually probe information through time-like signals on massless fields. Those time-like signals cannot be read by telescopes because telescopes are pretty classical. You need quantum antennas. You need antennas that you can prepare in superpositions of excited and ground state. With those antennas, in principle, you can signal using time-like signals. So there might be more information coming towards us right now than we actually see when we look at light. That's mainly one of the lessons we learned from analyzing this from the perspective of communication, analyzing field, quantum field theory with an eye on communication and communication capacity. Any questions about this? This ends the quantum collect calling bit. And I want to make a comment for which I need light about this. Yeah. About the single mode approximation now that we've seen communication and causality. Any questions? I'm glad you have none. I'm not so glad. I actually like questions. But what I mean is that these things are very anti-intuitive when you think of it with a classical intuition. I do have the feeling that when people, above all because of particle physics, great, has done a lot of harm because it's trained us into thinking of quantum phenomena in quantum field theory as classical processes, maybe funny ones, but classical processes. A lot of classical intuition, as in, right, photon disintegrates into two particles, and these two particles virtually annihilate, create another photon. That picture in our minds, which is, by the way, an order in perturbation theory, I keep saying that thing is not real, that's a mathematical artifact. If I am a very wise person that knows how to solve those problems without using perturbation theory, where are my virtual particles? I'm not saying the intuition is bad, it's good, actually helps solve problems. Intuition is always good. But it kind of also introduced some prejudices, which is trying to think of those processes as if they had classical analogs. As in like, to carry information, energy has to be carried, a real quanta has to just take it. I think that's something that we got from S-matrix. The prejudice of S-matrix, thinking of infinite timescales always, when most of these effects are actually lost in infinite timescales. All right, so quick comment. And I'm just going to illustrate it with the board and a paper here. And I wish I could do full screen. That's worse. I will just zoom in. And I lost the page, of course. Right. Is this the single mode? Yeah, this is the one. Anyway. All right. Let me just try to zoom in here. There we go. Now remember, we obtain that the signal in estimators, this Robi signal, the influence of detector A on detector B was proportional-ish as an integral. This is, of course, when you put a tilde on relational symbols, it means ish in different ways. So this is proportional to an integral over time of something that goes with the field commutator. Therefore, if the field commutator is zero, there's no signaling. So if you have your detector space like separated, no signaling whatsoever. What happens if we do what is called the rotating wave approximation? Here you have the Hamiltonian of the two detectors coupled expanded in field modes. The field is now expanded in field modes. And you see you get these terms that we discussed, the ones that the detector gets excited by absorbing a photon, if you want to think about it like that. The detector gets de-excited by emitting a photon. The detector gets excited by emitting a photon. The detector gets de-excited by absorbing a photon. These two terms are the two terms that are usually thrown out in quantum optics because, okay, if you look at, you can see how this term has a stationary phase. When this becomes a Fourier transform of the switching, we discussed that, remember, for long times that becomes a delta of this argument, and that means that it singles out one frequency, only one frequency contributes, whereas this one doesn't have a stationary phase. The delta never crosses zero. Okay, so that's how you neglect it, how you actually drop them, okay, for long times. Sometimes you will hear this explanation that you should reject out of hand, that, well, these ones conserve energy, these ones don't, because, you know, photon absorbed, photon emitted. Photon emitted, atom de-excited. And this is funny, because I have nothing, and then suddenly I have a photon and an excitation. That doesn't conserve energy. That is wrong, as we discussed, as an argument. It's not a good argument to make. Let's evaluate what happens with the causality of the model if we do that approximation. One of the contributions, this is not the full C, though. It's the first order square. So this is a lower bound on the causality violations. Okay, it's not going to be the full amount of causality violations. It's the part coming from this first order square, the U1, U1 part. All right, not the U2 part. So just that one. So if you compute that one, and you can prove that the other one adds up too. That's also done. If you compute that one, that contribution, you see something like this. Can you recognize something here? Who remembers the field commutator in three dimensions? This three dimensions, by the way. Three dimensions. Who remembers what the field commutator is like in three dimensions from yesterday? That one, right? Yeah. That thing. One divided by the distance, the deltas. So we have the field commutator. We have the contribution that is causal. That's the one that's proportional to the commutator. But we also have this thing. Look at that thing. Isn't it a monster? Is that thing zero in space-like separation? No. Just take space-like separation. That means this is larger than this. That's not zero in space-like separation. So if you did the rotating wave approximation, what you get is something like the causal term times something that violates causality. Of course, if you wait a long time, this is going to be small. Huh? If the detectors are far, it's also going to be small. Well, it depends. I mean, far from the light cone, that's what I mean. If you're far from the light cone, this is going to be small, but it's definitely non-zero. So if you are trying to do relativistic physics, you should know this. So if you are interested in anything relativistic, please do not do rotating wave approximation, because it's not nice to relativity. In fact, we can plot it just for fun. There you go. So here are two plots. This is one as a function of L, fixing several of the parameters. So here is typical parameters. So we fix the typical scales equal to 1. And then we only vary the scale of separation between the detectors. These red lines that you may or may not see is the light cone, when the two detectors are in light contact, depending on the distance of separation. There's also a time delay. That's why it's not at zero. There's a time delay between them. You see how it definitely peaks at light contact. That's thanks to the delta term that we have in there when we integrate. But there's a tail that makes it all the way slowly going down to infinity for sure, but it's there. It's violating causality. You can actually fix everything and be like, okay, I'm going to be in a space like, I'm going to be well space-like. This is actually, let's be the time of interaction is t. Let's be at the time separation plus 3 times that, meaning that definitely I would be already with 2 times that, I'm already space-like. Let's do 3 just to make sure. And let's see how it goes as a function of omega. And then you see how, when omega is of the order of that time, you get a huge violation of order 1. We're in the tails. We're evaluating the tails around here. Okay? And you see how when this omega is very small, it's of order 1. But as omega increases, which is the same as if omega is increasing, it's kind of the same as considering that longer times, because it's longer as compared to omega, to the frequency of oscillation. So this is oscillating very fast, the detector. You see how the thing decreases, not too fast. All right? The decrease there is not exponential. That's the point. So we consider convention to consider some approximation causality safe. Already, consider extended detectors. It's a little bit tricky because extended detectors see all the points along the detector at the same time. So it's a little bit causality violating too. If the detectors are small, though, we consider those things to be nice to causality, those approximations, considering the detector a Fermi-Walker rigid. We're considering causality respecting because the corrections, that the violations of causality are exponentially destroyed very fast. The ones that come from relaxing the single mode approximation are not exponentially suppressed. That's what we call harmful violations of causality. So yeah, do not ever do the single mode approximation if you're doing relativistic physics. Rotating wave approximation. Same goes for the single mode approximation. Think you're in a cavity, all right? If you're in a cavity and the cavity has modes in it, if you consider only one and you have 2 detectors and one sends a signal to another. Question, all the cavity modes are kind of sinusoidals. They're stationary waves in the cavity. Say it's a Dirichlet cavity. Can you express a propagating wave in terms of a sum of stationary functions? The answer is yes. We call that Fourier series. We can get that signal and you can express this as a sum of an infinite number of stationary functions. Second question, can you express a propagating signal as a function of only one stationary function? You cannot. If you have one stationary function, a single mode, only one sign, the 2 detectors that are space-like separated see the excitation that one does instantaneously, and B. To get propagating signals in a cavity, you need the many modes. Same way. So single mode approximation, rotating wave approximation, not nice to causality. They're fine in long-time regimes, as we talked, but if you care about relativity and you will have relativistic effects, you should not make them. And I think it was nice to talk about it now that we have tools to evaluate how much causality is violated. And I think that's it. The next tomorrow and Friday, we're going to see quantum energy teleportation, which is a quantum informational protocol that is the reverse of quantum collect calling. We're going to be able to send information from A to B, and without sending energy, we're going to get B to extract energy from a common source, from the information from A, which is kind of super cool. You're going to see that that's fantastic. Can you get energy out of the vacuum to the ground state of a field? The answer is, not alone, but yes, with teamwork, with LOCC. With teamwork, I can unlock zero-point energy fluctuations in particular. And for that, we're going to talk a bit about thermodynamics. We're going to talk about the passivity of thermal states, then something called local passivity and strong local passivity, and how can you break it with LOCC. If you touch the sun just very fast, you will not get burnt. We will discuss why, because thermality requires so cool, though. Thermodynamics is so cool. Anyway, and then we will apply that to the vacuum state of a quantum field. And we will see how we can do it. I'm actually going to do a toy model with 2 qubits, by the way. So the toy model I'm going to do is with 2 qubits, but you will have, possibly on Friday, some work on the application to fields. But with 2 qubits is enough. What is called the minimal QET model is enough to illustrate what we are doing here. How can we extract energy at B from the fluctuations of the ground state without A sending energy to B? Anyway, that will be tomorrow. And it's super cool. That's the result I love so much. Minimal QET.